Welcome to the Indisposable Podcast, produced by Upstream. I'm your host, Brookine Gatewood.
And I'm your co-host, Matt Prindeville.
Thanks for joining for another episode celebrating solutions to plastic pollution. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Indisposable Podcast. I am one of your hosts, Brookine Gatewood, and usually I am the interviewer. But for this show, the Upstream team asked me to sit on the other side of the conversation and talk about some of the philosophy and practices that I have shared with them over the years as their team culture coach. And there's a lot of things that I'm going to put today under an umbrella of embodied activism. And the work I do with Upstream is a lot about building a more learning-oriented, anti-racist, and thriving, not just stressing and surviving team. And it's vulnerable work, but it's also really enlivening because it tends to bring us into more of our humanity together as allies in our social change dream. And so I call this embodied activism to give it a name. And of course, first, you're probably wondering, what does that really mean? So it basically means doing the work to build the world you want to be living in a way that includes your heart and your spirit and your physical body. So you might now be asking, well, why is that so important? And what does it have to do with solutions to plastic pollution, which is probably what you came here for? Well, that's what this episode is all about. And first of all, plastic pollution, climate change, racial inequity, and many of the other social and environmental issues that we talk about on this show are all byproducts of extraction capitalism, which is a system that thrives on more and faster, on overwork, and on unsustainable use of resources, including ourselves. So the funny dynamic that shows up in nonprofits and social movement groups and entrepreneurial organizations is that most of us are part of this system, and so it's hard to not find ourselves playing the same game even as we try to change the system. We are scaling impact and speeding up solutions and overworking ourselves and each other in service of great goals, but sometimes losing connection with the deeper how we want to be doing the work, the heart of our motivations, and really with ourselves. Or at least I know this has happened to me many, many times, which is part of why I've really studied and am passionate about this topic of bringing the humanity and the body and our wholeness back into the how we do the work. And I've seen many colleagues and clients over the years struggle with it as well. And so I've learned a thing or two, which is part of what we're going to talk about today. And part of what I've learned over time through others further along the path that have taught me is that if we slow down and prioritize staying connected to our physical and emotional bodies and each other, not just our individual intellect and productive capacities, which we are most rewarded for in our culture, we actually have a much better chance of changing the world in the ways we want to be changing it and of doing our part to help create a future where there are no throwaway people or products. So that's why we're here today, talking about embodied activism. And I decided that this was a tough episode to try to do alone, so I invited an old friend to support me in it, Cy Thacker, who's been one of my teachers and collaborators in this arena for many years. Cy and I have hosted experimental and experiential physical dialogue workshops on sticky issues like gender and power, and have geeked out on this topic of embodiment in and at work quite a bit. He's got a deeper background than I do in somatic training himself, and he's the one I call when I'm stuck personally or professionally. So I called him to help me out in my stuckness preparing this particular show. And what follows is our wonderful and winding conversation that goes wide and deep and yet somehow only scratches the surface, really. We cover the transformative powers of pleasure, curiosity, grief, and taking responsibility. We share physical tips and tricks for working with what happens to our creature bodies in the fight and flight and freeze of conflict. We talk about some science and some insights from my Irish mother. And toward the end of the show, we share a lot of resources where you can learn more, also in the show notes. And if you like this theme, we'll come back to it. So enough of this solo banter from me, and let's step into the conversation. I sincerely hope you enjoy this one. Cy, thanks for joining.
Good to be here.
So Cy is I'll give a little intro that he might not, but he's got a lot of background in body work, particularly Feldenkrais, if any of you know what that is. He did some deep training and very subtle body work. And he and I have both worked with Arnie Mandel's process work a good amount. And What else, Sai? There's so many things. Sistema, different martial arts. Tell us a little bit about your context for what embodied activism means to you. And then I just cheated. Then you can ask me.
I think more and more in practice, the practices that I've worked with just sort of meld into a general embodied curiosity. And I think that may be where we're going today. I have had martial arts and dance and the five rhythms and other movement practices, as well as, like Brooking said, process work and Feldenkrais, and they all come together in just a general curiosity about what the body has to say about what we're doing and our work. And I think embodied activism and embodied curiosity might be the same thing for me. I think to just start it off, being curious is one of the most radical things that you can do in opening up a situation, especially a difficult situation.
Yeah. So curiosity, that's a brilliant entry point. Say a little more about why it's such a radical act.
I think that it's a radical act because you are coming from a starting point of presuming that you don't know. And being open to new information in a difficult issue, you know, that is, if there's a conflict that you're working towards an opening or resolution, and the one thing that we can presume is that not everyone has all the information. And if you're working to teach something or be an activist, you can presume that, again, not all the information is there. And also that the information is maybe not known, but is right in front of you, or right inside you, or right present to you, or to the group that you're working with. Now, Brooking, what does embodied activism mean to you?
Well, what you just said reminded me. So I recently hosted a meeting for the plastic pollution community for the National Reuse Network, which some of our listeners are part of, and maybe even were in this meeting. And I was working on every time I'm going to host what I know is a contentious conversation, because this was about the issue of plastic reusables. And people have big feelings and big opinions about that issue in this movement as to whether we want to push for no plastic at all, or whether there's a need to have a stepping stone of using plastic reusables while we build this new economic sector. And so I was working on ground rules for that meeting. And I feel like that's a good sort of segue into, you know, your piece about opening with curiosity. One of my ground rules is suspend certainty. There's always more to learn. And another is practice curiosity, engaging difference with interest. That we're having a dialogue and not a debate. And so the difference between dialogue and debate is you're positioning to be right and to win. And dialogue is you're looking together at a question, and you're looking to open the question and see how you can both be changed and transformed by the conversation. And so I do feel like, I love that you start with this curiosity piece. And in my experience with coaching and having worked in different versions of activist communities for a long time, it's just a part of human nature that, especially in our professional context where we've built identity and reputation and our finances are on the line, the risk of being perceived as not knowing can feel deeply threatening. And it can trigger the parts of ourselves that feel like we're going to die if somebody realizes that we don't know the answer. And so that willingness to sit in the unknown is, as you say, it's such an important foundation, and it's a deeply uncomfortable experience. And many of us don't have a background that would support us being able to rest in that as a okay place to be. And we'd actually just experience the unknown as deeply threatening. And if we feel fear and threatened, curiosity isn't possible. So there's a lot that comes up in that space of how we're relating with the fact that we don't know the answer and that we care. And those together, like just working with that combination, really is the root of a lot of where these pieces of what embodied activism is about for me come from. And I guess the one other piece I would name is that, and it's related, but so much in the sort of modern Western American professional and academic training oriented nonprofit world, so much is rooted in what's your strategy, what's your framework, what's your theory of change, all of these conceptual overlays on the change work, when from a movement justice power building perspective, those are actually not the most important pieces for long-term change. But those are the pieces that get asked for and rewarded by our current system, particularly foundations in the US. And so I feel that to take an embodied approach to activism in this country with the financial structures that we have for supporting nonprofit work is very radical and in some cases risky. And that risk is shifting over time. And the plastic space, I think, is a great example of one of the more progressive and integrated spaces that I've worked with. But there's a lot of old habits that we all carry. And there's a lot of stuff going on in our nervous systems when we show up in conversations and conflict that if we don't have tools, practices, understanding, awareness of, we just fall down the rabbit holes of politics and infighting and ego battles and all that just gets in the way of actually moving together toward a shared vision. So that's my first cut at trying to speak to the big topic relatively succinctly.
Yeah. So I think the environment that you work in is particularly challenging in the corporate and nonprofit environments where expertise has a premium. That's what you're being paid for. And to be an expert in not knowing is what I see some of the people like Arnie Mandel who really express this in a beautiful way. That's a hard sell.
Yeah, but there is something, at least for me, that I'm always reminded when I do share some framework with a group and they get so much value out of it that I want to say it's like we're spiritually hungry, and to find nourishment at that level, showing up inside of the work, lights people up. And it's also just so important because we know that burnout is such an issue in a lot of sectors, but particularly I think in the nonprofit sector, because people work harder for less and it's mission motivated. But the spaces where I see people able to sustain are the spaces where they have developed the understanding that we don't need to be insanely productive every minute to be effective as a movement. We're not letting people down if we take a break to take care of ourselves and to get present in our own bodies so that we can show up for the work in the way we want to be showing up rather than doing everything from stress and overwhelm, which just does not. We can't be the change we want when we are operating from the old paradigm, right? Einstein said, you can't solve a problem from the same consciousness that created it. Audre Lorde said, the master's tools will not dismantle the master's house. So that taking the time and space to do our inner work as part of our activism so that we know what center feels like in our own bodies, and we can sense when we're not on center, and we have tools to help bring ourselves back. Another Michael Mead quote is coming to mind that, you know, the ship is always off course. Every sailor knows that, right? That sailing is about continuing to come back onto course. And I feel when we're doing this kind of work where our heart is involved and our minds are deeply challenged and activated, when we're dealing with painful contexts and people suffering and a lot of external pressures, to have some practices and ways to come back to that sort of still center and source of strength internally, to me, that's sort of the essence of embodied activism, is that commitment to continue to come back, and as much as we can to come from that deeper place in how we show up for the work, because that's where the real transformation starts.
Yeah, that's the shift from productivity to creativity, I think. Productivity is still very much in that model and those tools that have got us to where we are. And how do we turn to the pleasure of the creative within, especially within an institutional context?
So what have you learned about that? I happen to know you personally, and I know that you have your own struggles with the productivity to creativity transition. And so I'm curious, what have you learned? What are the practices and ways and tricks, tips and tricks in your experience?
I think one way is really to begin to orient toward pleasure. Are you really enjoying, in a very physical way, are you really enjoying what you're doing? Are you present and enjoying the process of it? Because we live in a world where that basic embodied enjoyment of anything is judged and thought to be not productive enough, and it's, you know, risky and it's dangerous or it's lazy. So to orient back to that is difficult, but it just is just a requirement to come back again and again and say, am I enjoying this, or how could I enjoy this? How could I enjoy this more?
Reminds me, there's a great book that came out recently called Pleasure Activism by Adrienne Marie Brown.
Yeah.
And the whole book is about this, different variations on the theme, but yeah, how letting, like, even the idea that pleasure could and should be an orientation is pretty radical.
Yeah, I see that, and certainly not just out in the world. I know it in myself, the orientation, even when we're doing our own embodiment work, our own inner work, to orient to it as work. I'm doing my work. I'm doing my work. I'm doing my work. And yeah, there's productivity thing. And there's this idea that, you know, you go on enough retreats, you go on enough workshops, you go on enough this and that, and you know, you take enough yoga classes, and then you're going to have done your work.
Good call out.
And I think orienting to the pleasure of it really turns that on its head.
I'm reminded as you say that about how the power of playfulness and how you and I call each other when we're stuck and taking something too seriously. And in our relationship, we've developed, I mean, this is another solution, is have these people in your life that can help you kind of snap out of it. And I'm just thinking of the times where one of us has had something that we were feeling very serious about and needed help with, and the other usually starts with helping you see it with more lightness, more levity, and play. And then that gives breath, if you know, to whatever it is. It's, you know, I'll call you with work challenges sometimes, and by the end you've got me laughing, right? So that's another version of bringing the pleasure in. And it also ties into me, this is so simple, but breath is just crazy powerful way to, for those of us especially who have to sit at a computer for a good portion of our days, you know, and I use like intentional regulation of the breath a lot to come back to center in the middle of a meeting. I might be facilitating a meeting, which I do all the time, and something's happening, and then I'll just do my slow Qigong breathing. So there's this very simple idea of a square breath. That's one of the most distilled versions of meditation you can do. And you can do it in 1 minute, you know, but if you're in a conversation and you feel yourself tensing or getting triggered in response to somebody, or you can just, you're noticing that your mind is a little bit in the hamster wheel and spinning and stuck in that productivity orientation, you breathe in for 4 and then hold for 4, out for 4. Hold for 4, and repeat that 3 or 4 times. And it trips up your nervous system and helps reset the vagus nerve so that you can shift out of that fight, flight, freeze response and into the relaxation response. And that really, really helps just give your body a chance to slow down and then be able to choose a response rather than react.
Well, I'll jump in with a counterpoint to that.
Okay, great.
So I think about the word recentering, and I can take that as having two meanings. One of them is what you've said, is to come back to the center, come back to your breath, draw a square around it, and come back to that place where you're well-resourced and kind of the place where you started from. The other is to shift your center to wherever you find yourself heading in the moment. And so this is a lot of the
dancer part of you, right?
This is the dancer, and this is the clown part. You know, when you're talking about what we do for each other, that kind of points to the need for a sacred clown in the work environment, because it is, you know, everybody's just going for it. It's very, very serious all the time. And so the capacity to go, okay, I'm maybe a little dysregulated. I'm pulled off of my center. Something is calling me away from the center. You know, I can choose to kind of, you know, take a deep breath. You know, I'm going to settle myself down. Everything's okay. Like, I'm not going to, I wouldn't want to like express anything too much. I'm getting a little out of hand. And instead kind of go into it. So what I'd like to do increasingly with myself and with people is what I call hate yoga, which is if you're getting drawn off track by something that you're frustrated or hating or irritated, you know, working with your Irish temperament, this is...
Don't tell them. They don't know about my Irish temperament.
They don't know about your Irish temperament.
I come back to center so effectively. They've never seen it.
Brittany has a healthy Irish temperament, which as I see her recenter towards, I see her grow into the fullness of her expression and then find a balance between that square breath and center point and the new center of being expressive and, you know, able to hit some of those high notes, so to speak. You can kind of think of it as high notes and low notes. You're going down to the low note of centering, or you're going up to the high note of, you know, shifting something. And so to get fully, bring yourself fully into whatever is, whoever you're frustrated at, and to enjoy that, again, here's the pleasure piece, is to enjoy wherever you have shifted to. And find the pleasure within that recentering. And then you can bring the breath to that experience of frustration or hatred or, you know, irritation. We come into the fullness of that. We can enjoy that. And that allows us to stay socially engaged. That allows our ventral vagal systems to stay online, our pleasure systems to stay online, so that we can be annoyed, irritated, hateful, Irish, whatever it may be, and still be connected to others. I think about your mom with this.
My mom is 100% Irish, and I recognize it's edgy territory to link somebody with stereotype, but in my family we do it with love, and when my mom is being wild and full of emotions, my dad will say, "Your mother's Irish," with love and a smile. And so in our family, Irishness means you're being full of vim and vigor and life force.
And what I know about her and what I know about you in that I think she's offered you is that you enjoy that. She enjoys it. There's a great pleasure in that fire, even when it looks like distaste or displeasure. There's still... Mm-hmm. An enjoyment of it.
Yeah, I mean, the polarity that you're bringing out is a really important one in terms of there's a value in being able to choose calm and gracefulness and centeredness and being able to choose whether you react or not. And there's also a value in expressing, and the calm thing can easily get taken too far to be repressed, basically, and to be emotionally so contained that we actually aren't showing up fully, and that's not full embodiment. That's a certain kind of withdrawn energy, which again is pretty common, I think, in the workplace, because at least you don't get in trouble for it, you know? But to create the kind of safety and culture and environment where that fuller expression is welcome, I think everybody has a lot more fun, like you're saying. Yeah. And it can be playful. It can be fun. It can make conflict easier. It can be a really beautiful thing. And to be able to be in that kind of team environment or movement culture or whatever your context is a blessing, I would say. If you've got a group of people that are able to do that, it's also usually a sign that people are loving, respectful, and trusting of each other. If they're able to do that in a good way, that's not hurtful. And if there is a hurtful moment, to just recover and have the skills to say, hey, that actually didn't feel good. Can we talk about that and move forward? So it's a great point you bring.
And in that, we have to recognize conflict as not a problem. Anytime we're seeing conflict as a problem, there's no energy, because conflict is engagement. And even if we don't have all the tools to engage in the full conversation, we can at least respect and embrace that conflict means two sides are very, very engaged passionately on an issue. And how do we channel that? Can we channel that into more dialogue, even if it's fiery? And so, to enter as much of a space where we're not trying to really necessarily pay attention to all the trigger warnings. I mean, that's a difficult issue. People will get triggered. The problem with getting triggered in the, you know, way that we think about it, you know, online trolls online and whatever, is that people trigger and then walk away. They trigger and then they leave the relational space. And so there's no doorway there to then use that creative energy, that creative fire, that conflict engagement to actually come to a new resting place and a new answer or a new trajectory. And so, you know, I don't have a problem with people being triggered all over the place, as long as there's that relational space to stay within, so it has a chance to work itself out. I don't think we should avoid those spaces, but I do think we need to contain them and bring enough people into them. And this is, I think, what you do in your work, enough people into them that there's enough resource, enough grounding, enough centering, that the whole environment can use that cauldron to transform and learn.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, like, real systems change work is relationship work. Yeah. To exactly what you're saying, because if we want to be able to really shift dynamics, the dynamics that are usually driving the system at a local scale, at least, are relationships. And to be able to engage the conflict and, as you say, engage it rather than run from it. And the reality is so many of us have instinctive avoidance or over expectation responses to conflict. Again, the fight, the flight, the freeze. We all have tendencies toward one or the other of those. And it's helpful to know that about ourselves and then to learn to work with that in different ways. For example, one of the interesting physiology of conflict things is, if you get ticked off and angry, I mean, I just said that if we were on video, as soon as I said the word angry, my fist tightened up into balls. That's just what my body did. As soon as I just imagined being upset with somebody and I'm ready to fight. That's what we might call the Irish part, the part that's like ready for a fight. Like, that is in me. And I know that. So I've actually studied when that comes up. If it's somebody I feel safe with, like you, and you've helped me learn to do this over time, because I have that fire and I've been so concerned about burning people with it that I've really learned to manage it maybe too much. And you've helped me let it out a little more because we have such a trusting relationship. So anyway, the hands want to fist up and the hearing gets narrow, the vision gets narrow, the energy rises in the chest and the whole body starts to get ready for a fight. But when that happens, I might just be in conversation with a colleague who's just done something that's minorly irritating to me, you know, but my body's still reacting like that. So that's where I have these choices, and it's going to depend on the moment, and it's going to depend on the level of trust with that person. So if it happens with you, we might start wrestling, you know, or I might pretend to punch you in the face or whatever, because we have a very deep rapport around that and we can laugh, and then it helps my body release it and we move on. If it happens in a work context with somebody where I might not be in a power position, to be honest, or there's lots of reasons why you might not, then it's kind of fun to play with, okay, so my fist just balled up, to let it ball up maybe under the table or whatever, and to start paying attention to my peripheral hearing, because that'll help my body calm down, to do the square breathing, because that'll help my body calm down. Because there are these times where you want to back off of the impulse. Different example, if you're a person who tends to freeze, like your shoulders usually contract and your belly contracts and your arms, it's almost like you want to curl up in a ball. If you're one of those people and that's happening in the middle of a work meeting and you shut down and you can't speak, you know, but you need to speak and you need to show up for the conversation, then you do different things like deep belly breathing, try to wiggle your fingers and toes to start to feel your body again and slowly come back to the shape, the embodied shape of your own power as opposed to cower, right? And then with the flea, one of the fun things that I like to play with there is if the flea's happening, you might notice, I mean, I'm doing it right now and my legs are going into a run. My left foot wants to hit the ground and take me into a sprint to get away from the situation, and just noticing that and allowing that and then checking your surroundings. Oh, actually I'm safe. Like there's not a tiger chasing me. This is just a person who said something in a way that freaked me out. And then I can come back to center enough to be able to communicate. Because to what you're saying, it requires that people kind of be not in the deeper trigger where they actually can't communicate, which is a big challenge in group conflict when people shut down verbally.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it speaks to the importance of a network effect within a workplace or within any environment, because the more people who have the capacity to stay centered, stay present in the room, the more places you can go. And the more that the group has kind of agreed to you know, do its own exploration, that there are commitments in place and kind of contracts in place, people know that there won't be retaliation. But it also points to me to the necessity of an outsider like you, who mm-hmm. is able to take on the unspoken voice, take on the voice that is in the position that somebody is too scared to do, or too shut down to do, or too activated or dissociated to do. And because you have a neutral position and you at least, you know, can trust in your role to some degree. You're also in a position of greater privilege than many, so you have that luxury, and that's a great use of that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'm reminded of this world work approach that you and I have done that none of us have been able to do in the last year and a half of the pandemic. But if you are able to actually physically be in a room with the people that you're in some sort of difficult conversation around, to set up spaces in the room for each voice in the conversation. And then people can move their bodies around. And then, yeah, if there's a voice that has not yet been represented or spoken, whoever notices it, and if nobody else, the facilitator, be like, hey, what about the voice of the earth herself, as we're talking about, a conflict in plastic pollution, or the voice of future generations? Those are often voices that aren't considered right away. But then when you bring them into the conversation, voices that literally do not yet have a voice, at least verbally, and then people can move around in the space and stand with the different perspectives on an issue. And it's a very different way to have a dialogue. And it's really powerful and kind of fun. And it also can open up space for parts of the conversation that we don't always get to have. For example, I'm thinking about a process I did around this with climate. And when you bring in the voices of future generations and the earth herself and the plunderers, I think was one of the roles we had, the plunderers of the earth, it opens up the emotional space so that we can feel some of the deeper parts of of this work, or the world work as it's called, and one of those parts is often grief. And I know that you have a lot of interesting reflections and experience working with unprocessed and unacknowledged grief, and I would love you to speak to that a little bit.
So one thing that I see in a lot of people doing, particularly environmental work, is a lot of withheld grief.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the world around us is changing. I'm not going to say that it's dying, because I don't believe that it is dying. We may die. The people we love may die. The animals that we love may die. We may not have a future as a species, but the earth will go on. It will change, and there will be new species, and there will be new climates. So in this desperate attempt to save ourselves, we end up more and more in that productivity mindset. Again, that same place, mm-hmm. that same trap. And I see taking time for grief in those communities to cry and acknowledge the trees that have been cut down, the forests that are burning up in many parts of the world right now, the oil spills, there's so many of these things that are happening every day that a lot of the time, we're not going to have the space and time to grieve them to the point that we aren't a little bit stuck. You know, either we're going to turn off the radio, or we're going to get angry about it and maybe even galvanized to do something. But there's some reason, there's often a reason, and there's a desire at some level to avoid the experience of having to grieve the things that we are losing. Mm-hmm. And that keeps us, we're not immortal, nor is our species immortal. And to take the time to acknowledge that, it just takes time, and we don't have a lot of time, especially in a productive place, especially with, kids to feed. And
what I often hear is people will worry that they will fall apart and not be able to function if they feel the level of grief for everything happening in our world right now, not just to the planet, but the planet and the people on the planet and all the suffering, all the injustice, all the loss of species, lives, ecosystems. Yeah, I often hear that people just don't even know how to go there. And also that it's hard to go there alone, which I think is real. Some of the most powerful grief work that I've had the opportunity to do was
Sibon Fusome,
somebody who trained with him in an African grief ritual. And the whole idea of the ritual is, of course, it's a communal process. Like, how could we feel these things alone? That's just not even supposed to be how it is. And that there would be an altar to different altars. I'm trying to remember this event I did. One was to the ancestors. One was to the earth. But the important part is you're in a community. There's music happening. And at some point, somebody gets moved, like the grief enters. And then they go up and sit in front of the altar. And then somebody else puts their hand on their back and keeps their hand on their back until the person has moved through that wave of grief. And then they go back and sit in the community again. And just like that, one by one, as the grief moves through us, we step forward to feel it and express it in this community space. And always somebody comes and puts their hand behind you to say, you're not in this alone. And it's just such a beautiful and powerful way to work with those bigger feelings that it is harder to feel in isolation. And we don't have a lot of healthy grief rituals within the world of activism. Some communities do, but I think there's probably a lot of room for more supporting each other with what's hard in the work and the deeper reasons that our hearts are in it. One of the things that I notice is we often have trouble coming from the heart because that's where the grief is also, So to be able to work the grief is also to be able to come from love more fully.
And I think that it's not just that it's impossible or it's difficult to experience that and grieve and feel that on your own. It's also that you really grow through experiencing it with others, and the hole that is left, the emptiness that is left, has an opportunity to be filled with more connection as you are able to connect with the community around that loss. Mm-hmm. And we're not really meant to grieve alone. It's like purging with nothing to fill up with. And that, I think, is what people are afraid of, is that they'll never come back from that, which it takes time. In the Jewish tradition, there's sitting Shiva when somebody dies, which I think is 7 days, where you take away all the chairs and all the comforts, all the mirrors, and you just sit with people and your family and feel. And it takes longer. It's not a 5-minute thing. And it's hard to fit that into the schedule. But I also have to question that concern about not being able to function, and to say that, yeah, you might not in the way that you did, and that may not be a bad thing. Mm-hmm. But not to diminish how scary that can be at all.
Yeah, and again, that's part of the transformational aspect of the commitment to the embodied approach to activism, or commitment to social change, the future we want to be creating, is to let ourselves be changed in the process. And I mean, part of even just being in conversation here with you, some of what you're saying, I feel the ways, you've been helping call me out on my growth edges for years, and I'm feeling it in this conversation too, and yeah, that willingness to let go of the idea that our value is what we produce and what we do is just such a free fall, such a leap of faith. I think particularly for those of us who grew up especially steeped in sort of white dominant culture and ideas of perfectionism and professionalism and, Puritan Protestant work ethic lineages. So it does feel terrifying. It really does, all the time. I mean, I feel that still all the time. I've been in this practice, for 10 plus years, and there's always edges I'm working with my patterning around these things we're talking about today. It takes time. It takes community. And I think that's the piece that, and what you were just sharing, that is really standing out for me. And as I was reflecting on, well, what does embodied activism mean? There's the being in your own physical body and what that offers, which is a gateway to so many things, but also the body as our communal body. And one of the most powerful, beautiful things that I have found in being part of the plastic pollution movement and Break Free from Plastic is I feel part of something larger. I feel part of a collective body. That is what a movement is. It is a collective organism, really. And we are orienting together, and it's so beautiful and so powerful and so meaningful and inspiring. And so to be in that body, to be in the collective, and to see these different groups and organizations finding ways to collaborate, working through the conflicts and challenges along the way, to being able to have enough collective power to actually transform the larger systems. And inside of that, all the way down to the level of how am I showing up today for these conversations? Who am I reaching out to? Who am I remembering to care about as a human being, not just as somebody who I'm sharing it to do with, right? So it's such a deep portal into all these different aspects of transformation and reclaiming our humanity in deeper and deeper ways. And that's what I love about being part of this movement, because I think it is doing a lot in beautiful ways. And why I wanted to do this episode is hopefully some of it will have some value. And I hope it's just a start of a conversation. I also want to say, I feel very kind of uncomfortable about this conversation to a certain degree, because there has been some as if I know, and that makes me squirm a little bit. And so forgiveness for moments when that has come across is I'm asking for. But yeah, I mean, ultimately coming from that place of curiosity and interest and love and deep belief in the power of embodiment and community and collective action. And Thanks for joining me, Sai, as somebody who's been part of my journey with this.
Well, I wanted to second the squirming piece. I think it's always something that comes up in these kind of conversations where it's like, okay, this has maybe been what I've learned through not knowing. And in no way should that be taken to be a substitute for asking great questions. And hopefully we've just opened up the questions here a little bit and started a conversation. I feel like we could easily go for another hour.
Yeah. And there's so, I just want to also, in closing, there's so many people who do this work in a deeper way than I do. And I've just been asked to touch on the topic because I host this, but I want to acknowledge some of those people. Again, we talked a bit about Arnold Mundell on the show today, who's with Process Work Institute. You and I both attended this embodied, I think it was called Embodied Social Justice Summit a couple of months ago, that had an amazing amount of tremendous speakers and people who spent years with this. One of them that comes to mind is a woman named Camille Barton, who has an embodied social change area of her work. Reverend Angel Kyoto Williams, who is a Zen priest who has incredibly incisive comments on this topic. There's so many. Are there others that you want to mention, Sai?
Both of those. I'll second. And I think Resma Menakem would
yes,
be
thank you.
The clear third additional.
Yeah. And I think we've mentioned it on this podcast, but just worth saying again, my grandmother's hands, especially for the context of doing environmental justice and racial equity work here in the US, is an incredible book about the somatics of racialized trauma held in the body. And he also gives a lot of good tools for some of the centering kinds of practices that we talked about today. And it's just an incredible resource. Highly, highly recommend that book.
I want to say one last thing, which it kind of comes out of the grief conversation, but it's about responsibility. And that I think that this practice of embodied activism is one of taking just a higher level of responsibility for what we and our ancestors have created, the pain that has been caused, the disconnection from our bodies that has been caused, and the genocide and the violence towards other species that continues to be present. And grief feels like a part of responsibility. And that is where, in my experience, where overwhelm transitions to purpose. I'm responsible as a descendant of my ancestors for what has come to today, not in a shaming way, not in I have to fix it all, not in I have to even fix it at all, but just I'm responsible for it. And that means I'm responsible for what comes now and what comes next. And sitting within that responsibility, I think, is a radical embodied act.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate you bringing that in. And it makes me want to just touch lightly on, some of the work that we've been doing at Upstream with this tool called the Drama Triangle, and the shifting from the blame and shame orientation, villain, victim, and savior orientation, which is pretty common in the nonprofit world, to claiming accountability and responsibility. And so that shift, to being able to be a creator of how we show up, whatever the circumstances, and a supporter of each other showing up with full agency and dignity and authenticity. And that piece around being able to own our own experiences of shame and catch ourselves when we want to blame and shift those to responsibility. Like that little piece of work that you just mentioned at the end is a big, powerful piece of work that the Upstream team is working on. And I'll actually put a link in the podcast notes to a little more about the Drama Triangle for those who might want to learn more about that. But the work is never ending. And So hopefully this episode has had some nuggets that have been of value to our listeners. If you guys like this show and you want to hear more on this topic, I could start interviewing some of the other, invite some of these folks who are experts on this topic to come speak with us. And as always, we appreciate your feedback. And thank you to all the listeners for all you guys do every day to build the more beautiful world we all want to live in. And Sai, thank you so much for joining me and chatting with us. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Brooke. Till next time.
And that's our show. If you like what you're hearing, help spread the word. Subscribe to the Indisposable Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Add a review, talk us up. Nobody spreads a message like you. The Indisposable Podcast is brought to you by Upstream, sparking innovative solutions to plastic pollution, envisioning a world without it, and empowering businesses, communities, and individuals to imagine and co-create this future with us. You can find resources mentioned on today's episode, as well as learn more about Upstream's work at www.upstreamsolutions.org. Follow us on social and join the movement. There's a better way than throwaway.